Good evening, everybody. I guess it's Happy International Storytelling Day. And it's also the first day of spring, so it's a very, very joyous occasion. Very sweet. My name is Perry Chafe, and I'm the Special Events Manager for The Rooms, and we're very pleased this evening to be celebrating International Storytelling Day with a couple of very gifted storytellers. But first, I guess I'll introduce our MC and storyteller for this evening, no stranger to The Rooms, or to the, I guess, the Heritage Conservation Cause, is Dale Jarvis. Dale has been telling stories and recording stories for years now, and he actually has a couple of publications out that I believe we have in our gift shop as well. A lot of them dealing with haunted stories and ghosts and all these sort of ghoulish things. But Dale is here this evening to actually help us celebrate International Storytelling Day, as well as introduce our keynote speaker, I guess, or storyteller from the West Coast, Eleanor Benjamin. And welcome to St. John's, Eleanor, on this very special day. So without further ado, I'm very pleased to introduce Mr. Dale Jarvis.
Thank you, Perry. Well, once upon a time, not in my time and not in your time, but a time long, long ago when everything was magical, when houses were papered with pancakes and owls made their nests in old men's beards, there was a king. Now, this king loved riddles and puzzles, and so he issued a great proclamation that went out to all the corners of the kingdom, and he invited all his subjects to send him riddles and puzzles that he could solve. And this is what people did. Now, one day the king came home, and there in the throne room, sitting on his throne, was a great box, a present for him. And he picked it up, he opened up the box, and inside the box there were three dolls. And the dolls all looked the same. And with the three dolls there was a note. And the note said, King, it said, here is your riddle for the day. He said, I want you to be able to tell me the difference between these three dolls. Well, the king looked at those dolls for a long time, and he couldn't tell any difference between them. They seemed to be exactly the same. They had the same number of stitches. They were made of the same material. They had the same clothes, the same painted faces. And the king was stumped. So he said, this calls for a wise man. So he called for the wisest man in the kingdom to come and to look at these three dolls and tell him what the difference was. And the wise man came, and he studied those dolls, and he looked at them and studied them very intently for a long time, and he thought many, many wise things. But he didn't say a word, because he didn't really know the answer, and he was afraid that if he said something, he would reveal that he wasn't perhaps as wise as he had advertised. And the king said, well, this man can help me not at all, and he sent the wise man away. Then the king had a thought. He said, sometimes a fool will see things where a wise man does not. And so he called for his fool. And the jester came in, and the jester looked at the three dolls. And the king said, I want you to tell me the difference between these three dolls. The fool looked at the dolls, and it played with the dolls. It juggled the dolls, but it couldn't answer the king's question. And so the king said, well, truly this fool is a fool, and it sent the fool away. Then the king said, I will call for my storyteller. And he called for the storyteller to come. And he told the storyteller, I want you to look at these three dolls and tell me what the difference is between them. And the storyteller, well, she came over and she picked up the dolls. And she looked at them and she said, well, king, she said, I can help you, but I have to do it in my own way. And the king said, do whatever you need to do in order to tell me the answer to this riddle. And the storyteller reached out and she took a hold of a hair in the king's beard and she plucked it out. Then she took that hair and she picked up the first doll and she started to thread the hair into the ear of the doll. And she threaded it in and the hair slowly disappeared into the ear of the doll. Well, she said, this is obviously the doll of a wise man. For everything it hears, it stores inside of its great head. Oh, said the king, well, that's the first doll. What about the second? And the storyteller reached out, and she took a hold of another hair in the king's beard, and she plucked it out. She picked up the second doll, and she started to thread the hair through the doll's ear. And this time, the hair went in one ear, and it came right out the other side. Well, she said, obviously, this is the fool, because everything that goes in one ear comes right out the other. Oh, said the king, very wise indeed. And she reached out, and she took a hold of a hair in the king's beard, and she plucked out for the third time, picked up the third doll and started to thread the hair into the ear of the doll. And this time, when the hair went in the ear, it didn't come out the other side and it didn't stay in the head. It came out the doll's mouth. Oh, well, she said, well, this is obviously the storyteller, because everything that goes in one ear eventually must come out the mouth. Well, thank you, said the king. You have solved the riddle of the three dolls. But in doing so, you have provided me with another riddle. He said, when you plucked that hair from my beard, it was straight. When you put it into that third doll's ear, it was a straight hair. But when it came out the doll's mouth, it was curly. He said, why is that? And she said, well, that's easy. She said, because every storyteller who hears the story, when they tell it, they put their own spin on that story, their own little curl, just as I have done in telling you this story. And our storyteller who's going to be telling us a story tonight is going to tell you some stories that she's learned in her travels, stories from all over the world, and she will undoubtedly put her own spin, her own little curl on those stories. So I'd like you to all join me as we welcome Eleanor Benjamin.
Well, thanks very much, Dale. It's really fun to be here. I couldn't decide if I was going to start with a fat story or a thin story, but I like fat stories, so I'm going to start with this fat story that, well, it comes from Sweden, but it comes from a lot of other places too. People tell this story in many ways in many places. And this version is called The Giant Who Had No Heart in His Body. There was a king. He had seven sons. And my, how he doted on those seven sons. He worshipped the ground they walked on. But he was a little, what we would call today, overprotective. He didn't want them to go out and do anything dangerous. He wouldn't let them learn how to swim because heaven knows one of them might be drowned. And if then were now, certainly he wouldn't let them learn how to use a skateboard or a snowboard, or any of those kind of things. But time comes and time goes, and at last the seven sons grew up, in spite of the king's best intentions. They grew up, and eventually they were shaving their mustaches with little golden razors. And they came to their father one day and said, Father, it is time for us to go out into the world, to go a-wooing and find ourselves princesses to marry. Oh, said the king. What'll I do here all by myself? I'll miss you so much. Oh, I couldn't bear for you all to go at once. Why don't the six older ones go and the youngest one, Boots was his name. Boots could stay here and keep me company. Boots thought about that for a minute. Didn't seem like such a good idea to him. But at last he said he would if his six older brothers would bring back a princess for him to marry to. And so it was agreed. The king went out and spent lots and lots of money to buy the six older sons fine suits to go a-wooing in. They were red and blue velvet, and they had golden buttons and golden braid and golden epaulettes on the shoulders. Then he bought them six fine white chargers. The six princes got up on their six fine white horses, and away they rode off into the world to go a-wooing. They rode. And they rode, and they rode. But try as they might, they could not find seven princesses that they liked well enough to think about marrying. And at last they were getting quite discouraged, and they came to a far distant kingdom. And there, in a distant palace, they found six princesses who were very, very nice. And the six princesses decided that they liked those six princes quite well enough. So they decided they would look for a seventh princess on the way home for Boots. The six princesses got up on the back of the six white horses, behind the six princes, and away they all rode, rainbow bright. And they rode, and they rode. And as they rode, they did all sorts of things to shorten the road. They told stories, they told jokes, they asked riddles, they sang a few songs. And they were having a most wonderful time. It just so happened the road they were on led past the house of the giant who had no heart in his body. Now the giant who had no heart in his body could only be killed if you could find his heart and destroy it. But those young people didn't know that. And the giant who had no heart in his body hated one thing above all others. And that was to see anyone have a good time. There he was at his house, looking out the door, when along came those six princes and six princesses, riding on the six white horses, laughing and talking and joking, and they were obviously having a good time. Just as they rode past his house, the giant looked out and fixed them all with his stony stare. And instantly, they were all turned to stone. Six stone princesses, six stone princes, and six stone horses. And the giant took them like they were a bunch of garden gnomes and set them up in his own garden. Time passed. Meanwhile, back at home, Boots was beginning to wonder what had happened to the princess they were supposed to bring him to marry. So he went to his father and he said, "Father, what is keeping my brothers? They promised they would bring me a princess to marry, and they're not here." "Boots," said the king, "how can you be thinking about a princess to marry when, for all we know, your brothers could be dead or drowned or dying in some ditch somewhere? How can you be so selfish?" "You're right, father," said Boots, "you're right. Maybe, father, you should let me go out into the world and see if I could find them." "Oh, no, my son, what would happen to me if something happened to you? Why, I'd be left all alone, and I think I would die of misery and loneliness. Father, if you don't let me go, we'll never find out what happened to them at all, at all." And the king had to agree that was right. "Well, Boots," said the king, "I don't have a fine white charger for you. I don't have a fine suit of clothes." "That's all right," said Boots. "I'll go the way I am. And I'll go take whatever horse I can find in the barn, and that's all right with me." Boots went out in his corduroy pants and his leather jacket to the barn. And there he found the most broken-down, sway-backed old nag you have ever seen in the world. It looked like it wouldn't be able to carry anyone more than the next corner. It looked like it wouldn't last very long. It looked like it was quite ready for the glue factory. But Boots didn't care. He hopped up on that horse as if it had been the finest war horse you could imagine. And away he rode down the road. He rode and he rode. And at last, in early afternoon, the road began to twist and turn a little. And out from a ditch, right in front of the horse, hopped a big raven. Big but thin and bedraggled looking. Gray, torn feathers. It stopped right in front of the horse. The horse stopped short. The raven looked up at Boots and said, "Excuse me, sir. You see how it is with me? I'm so hungry. I haven't eaten anything for days. I don't suppose you have anything in that satchel you have there on your horse's saddle that you might give me to eat?" "What's this?" said Boots. A talking raven. And he wants some of my lunch." "Oh." Boots was a kind-hearted young man. You need to know that. And so he took some food out of his satchel, got down off the horse, and gave it to the raven. The raven thanked him and said, "Wherever you go, sir, all you need to do is call on me, and I'll help you in your hour of greatest need." Boots thought to himself, "What could a bird do for me in my hour of greatest need?" But he got back on his horse, and away he rode. He rode and rode. And further on in the afternoon, now the road began to rise up a little and pass by a river. And just as he went around a turn, he looked to the side of the road, and there on the river bank was a salmon, right out of the water, flip-flopping back and forth. "That's odd," thought Boots to himself. And just as the horse passed by the salmon looked up at Boots and began to speak.
"Excuse me, sir. Oh, you see how it is here with me? Somehow I need to get back in the water or I will surely die. Please, sir, won't you put me back in the water? If you do, I'll help you in your hour of greatest need."
"What's this?" thought Boots. "A talking fish? Who's going to help me? What could a fish do for me ever in my hour of need? But I told you Boots had a kind heart, didn't I?" So he got off his horse, got down to where that fish was, picked it up and threw it back in the river. The fish turned around, flipped his tail, swam away,
Boots went back and got on his horse and continued on the road. Now the horse was beginning to wheeze and cough from the exertion of climbing the hill, and it really didn't look like he was going to last very much longer. They reached the crest of the hill, and at that very moment, out from the bushes came a wolf. But such a wolf, so thin, so bedraggled. And the wolf stopped in the road right in front of the horse. Well, the horse saw the wolf. He stopped short. The wolf looked up at Boots and said, "Excuse me, sir. I haven't eaten anything for 2 whole years. I'm so thin. When I breathe, I whistles. Please, sir, could I eat your horse?" "Wait a minute," said Boots to himself. "First a talking raven wants my lunch, and then a talking fish wants me to put him back in the water, and here's a wolf that wants to eat my horse." "I don't think so, wolf," said Boots. "If you eat my horse, what am I going to ride on?" "You could ride on me," said the wolf. Boots looked at the wolf. Then he looked at his horse. And it did really seem that that horse was pretty close to being ready for the glue factory. "I told you Boots was a kind-hearted young man, didn't I?" He looked at the wolf and said, "Oh, all right, wolf, you may eat my horse." Well, the wolf came over. Boots took off the saddle and the bridle. And the wolf started in to eat that horse, and I can tell you he wasted no time. But as he ate, the wolf began to get bigger and fatter and fuller and taller. His coat got all shiny and glossy. Pretty soon he was as big as a horse himself. So Boots took the saddle and put it on the horse, took the bridle and put it on the horse. And then the wolf said, "All right now, get up on my back, Boots." And Boots was happy to get up on the wolf's back. And away they rode like the wind. They rode and rode and rode until at last they came right to the front door of the giant who had no heart in his body. "Boots," said the wolf, "this is as far as I can take you. This is the house of the giant who has no heart in his body. And this is where your brothers are. The giant has put a spell on them, and if you want to rescue them, this is where you have to be. You have to kill the giant who has no heart in his body." "How am I going to do that?" said Wolf. "Well," said Boots. "Well," said the wolf, "in that house there lives a princess. And I believe that she would help you if you ask her." And with that, the wolf was gone. Boots went up to the front door of the house and knocked on it. The door opened and there was a princess. Such a nice princess. Boots had never seen such a nice princess. And she looked at him and she said, "What are you doing here? Don't you know what this place is? This is the house of the giant who has no heart in his body. If he comes home and finds you here, oh, it's all over for you. If I were you, young man, I'd run away as fast as I could." Boots thought about that for a minute. It seemed like a very good suggestion to him. But then he remembered. He was supposed to be rescuing his brothers, and besides, the princess was so nice. "Princess," he said, I've heard that maybe you could help me. You could help me find the heart of this giant and kill him." "I don't know about that," she said, "but I could try. But he's going to come home any minute. Why don't you come in now, and you can hide under his bed, and we'll see what we can do, and you listen and see what you can hear." So Boots came in, went right under the bed. It was just in time. He just made himself comfortable under the bed when he heard thump, 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 thump. It was the giant coming home from the woods. The door flew open. In came the giant with a sheep under one arm. He looked around the room and he went, "Fee-fi, I smell Christian blood."
"My goodness," said the princess, "what a good nose you have, giant. Would you believe that just this very day a raven flew over the top of our house, dropped a human finger bone down the chimney into the pot of the soup, and that's what you smell now? Oh, you're so clever, giant. I'm so lucky to be your servant."
"Hmm," said the giant. "That makes one,"
Giant went over to his table, sat down, and swallowed the sheep in one gulp. The princess went and got in her bed. The giant went and got in his bed. And after a minute or two, the princess spoke up. Oh, giant, are you awake?
I am, princess. What do you want?
Giant, I've been thinking all day about your heart, you know, the one that you don't keep in your body.
Of course, it's the only one I've got. What about it?
I've been wondering about where you keep it. I've been actually quite worried about it, Giant, because I'd like to know that it's in a safe place. I would be so upset if anything happened to it, Giant.
Of course it's in a safe place. Do you think I would not keep my heart in a safe place?
I would feel so much better, Giant, if I knew what the safe place was.
Hmm? Oh, all right,
said the giant.
I will tell you. I keep my heart under the front doorstep, where no one will ever get to it.
And under the bed, Boots went, uh-huh. We'll see about that. Everybody went to sleep. And in the morning, the giant got up and he went off to the forest to do whatever it is giants do when they go off to the forest. Boots came out from under the bed. And he and the princess went and found a pickaxe and a shovel. They moved the big stone away from under the front door and they began to dig. They dug and they dug and they dug. Now, do you suppose they found the giant's heart? What do you think? No? You're right. They did not find the giant's heart. And the princess said, what a nuisance it is to be the servant of such a lying, cheating, tricky fellow as this giant. But Boots, look at the mess we've made. If the giant comes home and sees this, he's going to know that I've been looking for his heart. I think we'd better put everything back the way it was. So they filled in the hole. They pushed the stone back. But you could tell something had been disturbed. The princess went off to the forest and she came back with some plants she dug up and some flowers and she planted them all around the edge of the doorstep. Made it look real pretty. Boots went inside, he climbed under the bed and it was just in time because very soon after that they heard thump, 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 thump. It was the giant returning from the forest. The door flew open and in came the giant with a cow under one arm. He looked around the room.
Fee-fi-fo, I smell Christian blood.
My goodness, giant, you're so, so clever, said the princess. Would you believe it happened again today? Mm-hmm. Just like yesterday, giant. Mm-hmm. Another raven flew over the roof and dropped another human finger bone down the chimney into the pot of the soup. And that's what you smell. Mm-hmm. You're so clever, giant. I am so lucky to have to work for you.
Hmm,
said the giant.
That makes two.
He went over and sat down at his table, took the cow and swallowed it in one gulp. After a bit, the princess climbed into her bed, and the giant climbed into his bed. A few minutes passed, and this time it was the giant who spoke.
Princess!
Yes, giant, what is it?
When I came home from work tonight, I couldn't help noticing all those plants around the doorstep. What is going on?
Oh, you noticed, did you? Oh, giant. Well, I'm glad you noticed, because when you told me that's where you kept your heart, I was so happy. I just had to go out and do a little gardening and landscaping, make it look all pretty.
You silly goose,
said the giant.
Do you think I would keep my heart under a doorstep?
Well, that's what you told me. You mean it's not under the doorstep?
Of course not, said the giant. I would never keep my heart in such a stupid place.
Giant, you've ruined my day. Now,
I don't know how I'm going to be able to do my work tomorrow because I'm going to be so worried about your heart. Tomorrow, Giant, I was thinking of making a great big batch of raisin bread, your favorite. I don't know if I can do that tomorrow or not, if I have to worry about where your heart is.
Oh, very well, said the giant. I'll tell you where I keep my heart. I keep it in the old cupboard out in the hall where no one will ever get to it.
Underneath the bed, Boots went, aha, we'll see about that. Everybody went to sleep. Morning came. The giant got up. He went off to the forest to do whatever it is giants do when they go off to the forest. Boots came out from under the bed. He and the princess went and got a saw and a crowbar and a hammer, and they set to work on that old cupboard out in the hall. They took it apart board by board, nail by nail, until there was a nice neat pile of boards and a bunch of nails. And they looked and looked and looked. Do you suppose they found the giant's heart? No, of course they did not. Oh, said the princess, that is so annoying. He lied to me again. Oh, but you know, if he comes home and finds we've taken the cupboard apart, I know he's going to get very, very angry. I think I better put everything back together. So the princess and Boots went and put everything back together, put all the boards back, nailed everything back together, but you could tell someone had been tampering with it. The nails looked so shiny where they pounded them back in. The princess went out to the kitchen and she got the best tablecloth in the house. She came back and spread it over the cabinet. Then she went out into the forest and picked a whole bunch of wildflowers, put them in a vase and set it on top, and it looked very nice. Boots went back under the bed to hide, and it was just in time. For right after that they heard thump, 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 thump. The door flew open. In came the giant with an ox under one arm. The giant smelled around the room. Fee-fo-fi. I smell Christian blood.
Goodness sake, giant. You are the cleverest giant in the whole world. Mm-hmm. Would you believe that today, this very day, another raven flew over the house and dropped a human toe bone down the chimney into the pot of the soup. And you can smell it, you clever, sensitive fellow, you.
Hmm, said the giant. That makes three.
He went and sat down at the table and took that ox and swallowed in one gulp. And then he went to bed. The princess went to bed. A few minutes passed, and then the giant spoke out again.
Princess, are you awake?
Oh, yes, giant, I am. What is it you want?
Princess, when I came home from work tonight, I couldn't help noticing that smelly pot of flowers out on the cabinet in the hall. What is going on?
Oh, you noticed? Oh, giant, when you told me that's where you kept your heart, I just had to go and decorate things up a little bit in celebration.
You silly goose, do you think I would keep my heart in an old cupboard out in the hall?
Giant, you mean you told me a fib?
I would never keep my heart in such a silly place.
You're not serious, Giant. Oh, you've ruined my day again, Giant. And to think tomorrow, I was planning on baking an enormous batch of chocolate chip cookies.
Oh, very well, said the giant. I will tell you where I keep my heart. Out in the forest is a lake. On the lake there's an island. On the island there's a church. In the church there's a well. In the well there's a duck. In the duck there's an egg. And in the egg I keep my heart, where no one will ever come to it.
Underneath the bed, Boots went, uh-oh. I don't know what I'm going to do about this one. But everyone went to sleep. Morning came. The giant went off to the forest to do whatever it is giants do when they go off to the forest. Boots came out from under the bed. He looked around. The princess was there. I don't know what we're going to do now, princess, he said. Just then there was a knock on the door.
Boots went to the door to answer it. And I wonder who was there. Any idea? Who do you think? The raven? That's a good guess, but no, it wasn't the raven. The fish? Good guess too, but not the fish. The wolf? Yes, it was the wolf. There was the wolf with the saddle and the bridle on him already. And he said, "Get up on my back, Boots, get up on my back." Boots got up on the wolf's back, and away they rode like the wind. They rode and rode far off into the forest. And after a long, 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 long time, they came to the lake in the middle of the forest. Boots could see the island in the middle. He could see the church with its tall steeple. But he didn't know how he was going to get out there. "Wolf," he said, "I don't know how I'm going to get out to the island. I never learned to swim when I was a boy." "Oh, that's no problem," said the wolf. "Just stay on my back and I'll take you there." So together they swam across the island, across the lake till they came to the island. Boots got off the wolf's back and went up to the front door of the church. Tried it, but it was locked. "Oh, no. What am I going to do now?" said Boots to the wolf. "Well," said the wolf, "I'm not quite sure." Boots looked up at the steeple of the church, and way at the very top he saw a hook, and on the hook, an enormous cast-iron key. "Ah, there's the key, but how are we going to get it down?" "I think," said the wolf, "it's time for us to call on your good friend, the raven." And so they called the raven once, twice, thrice, and it was there instantly and very happy to go and get the key from the top of the steeple. Down came the raven with the key, and it fit the lock perfectly. They opened the door and went inside. And there at the far side of the church was a well, a very large well, and a duck was swimming back and forth and back. Boots went over and waited at one side. The duck swam toward him. He reached for the duck, but she got away. He went to the other side. She swam toward him again, and this time he got hold of her around the neck and pulled her in. He went to lift her out of the water, and in that very moment she laid an enormous golden egg, which fell into the well and sank to the bottom. "What am I going to do now?" said Boots. "Well," said the wolf, I think you have a friend that you can call on now." And so they called on the salmon once, twice, thrice, and up from the water came the salmon, only too eager to go down into the water and fetch the egg. Quickly the salmon returned, and Boots picked up the egg. "Well, wolf, I've got the egg. What do I do with it now?" "Well," said the wolf, "take it and squeeze it around the middle gently." Boots took the egg, he squeezed it around the middle gently. Far off in the forest, they heard an enormous roar. It was the giant. "Someone is squeezing my heart. Please don't squeeze my heart. I'll grant you whatever you ask for." "What should I ask for?" "Ask him to get your brothers back," said the wolf. And so Boots called out and asked the giant to get his brothers back for him. "It is done," replied the giant. "What do I do now?" asked Boots. "Take the egg," said the wolf. "Squeeze it around the middle as hard as you can this time." So Boots squeezed the egg as hard as he could. And all at once, the egg burst in 1,000 pieces. Far off in the forest, the giant exploded in 1,000 pieces. They flew up, up, up in the air, and it was 5 minutes before they all came back down to earth again. The forest grew quiet. Birds began to sing again. Boots got up on the wolf's back, and together they rode away out of the forest and all the way back to the house of the giant. And there he found his 6 brothers and their 6 brides all waiting, and the horses were restored too. Boots went up to the door, and there was his very own princess, and it seemed to him that she looked even nicer than she had when he met her the first time. She climbed up on the back of the wolf with Boots, And all seven princes and princesses rode away back to their father's palace. When they got there, the old king was so happy. He threw a great feast, and the seven princesses married the seven princes, and they all lived very happily. And when at last the old king finally passed away, the six older brothers decided that it was Boots that should rule the kingdom in his stead. And Boots and the princess, together with a little help from the salmon and the raven and the wolf, ruled the kingdom wisely and well all the days of their lives. And now a much shorter one, much shorter. That was a fat one. Here's a thinner one. The first time I encountered a book of folk tales, I was about 8 years old. We didn't have a library. I didn't have very many books at home. And it was time for me to get my tonsils out. And some of you won't remember what it was like back in the old days, but this was in northern New Brunswick, and there were the Protestants at the Protestant school and the Catholics at the Catholic school, and never the twain met. And my mother was convinced that Catholics had two heads and horns, and all of the Catholics were convinced that we had two heads and horns. And my mother decided that she was not going to let me get my tonsils taken out at the Catholic hospital where all the nuns were, and they all spoke French. So she decided she would take me to Moncton for a Protestant tonsillectomy. Well, when we got to Moncton, she took me to Eaton's, and I had never been in a store with an escalator before. She said I could buy a book. We went on the escalator up to the toy department, and the books were off on the side, and there were hundreds and hundreds of books. How could I choose? I spent a long time deliberating, and finally I found one called Wonder Tales of Dogs and Cats by Frances Carpenter, missionary's wife. And I, after much angst over whether this was the right book or not, I said that was the one I wanted. And I took it to the hospital and I read all those stories. And it was my first encounter with folk tales from around the world. And I guess I probably got hooked back around then. But one of the stories in the book was called The Boy Who Loved to Draw Cats. And later on, when I decided I would really like to tell stories, that was one of the stories that came to mind. And it was one of the first stories I learned. And it's a story from Japan. It was collected by a man named Lafcadio Hearn, who's quite an intriguing person. I later went to Japan and started tracking down places he'd been and stories he'd collected, but I never did find the spot where this one happened. There was a poor farmer who had more children than he knew what to do. He and his wife were hungry all the time, and they worked so hard trying to feed their sons and daughters. The older children, the boys, could work with their father in the fields, and the daughters, as soon as they were old enough to help around the house, they helped out and they did all they could. But the youngest child was a boy, a weak little boy, not much good for anything, but he was very smart, and he asked lots of questions, and he loved to draw. Whenever he could find a piece of paper and something to draw with, he would draw. He drew pictures of cats. That was what he liked to draw the most. Everybody around said, "Oh, this boy is not going to make a farmer. You'll never make a farmer out of him, but he's rather bright. You know, he might have the makings of a priest. Why don't you take him down to the temple and see if they'll take him on and teach him how to be a priest, and then that's one less mouth for you to feed." So that's what his father did. He took him down to the temple. There was an old priest there who was very kind and friendly, and he asked the young boy a lot of questions, hard questions. And the priest could tell from the way the boy answered those questions that he was clever. And the priest agreed he would take him on and train him and teach him the things he needed to know to become a priest. Everything went very well. The boy was studying and learning well, but there was one little problem. He still liked to draw cats. And he liked to draw cats where perhaps cats should not be drawn. On the walls of the temple, on the columns of the temple, in the margins of his textbooks. The old priest spoke to him a lot of times and told him this, he should not be doing this, but that boy had the soul of an artist. He couldn't stop himself. He just had to draw, and he just had to draw cats. And one day he was studying from a great big book with beautiful wide margins, an old book full of many wise things. And all those margins, they were so white and so wide, so perfect for drawing. And the boy couldn't stop himself. He started drawing cats in the margin. The old priest came in and caught him. My boy, what am I going to do with you? I don't think we're going to make a priest out of you at all. Maybe you'll become a great artist one day, but certainly a priest you will not be, and you cannot stay here. You must leave. But before you go, I'm going to give you a little bit of advice. Wherever you go, when you find yourself in a large place at night, avoid the large place and try to find a small place to stay. And the priest left. The boy packed up its few belongings and wrapped them up in a handkerchief, tied them on a stick, and started off down the road, thinking about the strange words of the old priest. Avoid the large places at night. Find a small place. What on earth did that mean? Old priests often speak in riddles, but the boy couldn't figure that out at all. He walked on, wondering what to do. I can't go home. They'll be upset at me if I go home. They'll be annoyed because they'll have another mouth to feed. He thought for a while, and then he remembered, not far away, there was another town with a temple. A much bigger temple. His father used to take him there to sell vegetables at the market. Perhaps he could go there. Perhaps they would take him on to work in the temple. There might be room for him. He walked all day until he found the town where the temple was. He walked up the hill to where the temple stood. All the other lights in town were out. Everyone had gone to sleep, and there was one light left burning in the temple. So he headed toward it. He got to the temple, and he knocked on the door. But no one answered. He knocked again, and still no one answered. He tried the knob. The door wasn't locked, so he went inside. He sat down on a little bench by the door, and when his eyes got used to the dark, he noticed the place was dusty, full of cobwebs. Oh, people haven't been looking after this place very well, he thought. They'll certainly need me here. I can help clean. I can certainly dust away cobwebs. And in the morning when they come, I'll tell them I'll work for them if they'll just give me a little something to eat. And he sat there, and as his eyes grew more accustomed to the dim light, he noticed that the temple had walls all white all around him, very large walls. And as he looked at the walls, he thought to himself, "Ah, wouldn't it be nice to draw cats on that wall?" Over on one side of the room, there was a cabinet. On one side, it was one of those lacquered cabinets, all black and shiny, with chrysanthemums and dragons painted on the side. And there was a door that had a little cubicle on one side, and on the other, little tiny drawers. He pulled open one of the drawers, and he found a block of ink and some brushes. "Ah, just what I need," he said. "I can paint cats on the wall." He found some water, wet the ink, and began to paint the cats on the wall. Oh, he painted many, many kinds of cats. Fighting cats, sleeping cats, purring cats, mother cats with kittens, big cats, small cats, cats with their backs arched, friendly-looking cats, every possible kind of cat. And when he'd filled the entire wall with cats, he realized he was very tired. "Oh, I'll just stretch out here and go to sleep," he thought to himself. And then he looked at the room. It was a very large room. Very large. And then for some reason he remembered the words of the old priest, "Avoid large places at night. Find yourself a small place." He looked over to the side where the cabinet was, with that little compartment on one side. Just the right size for a small boy like himself to crawl into and sleep. And that's where he went. Closed the door behind himself and fell asleep. He wasn't asleep very long when he was awakened by a great screaming and shrieking sound. It got louder and louder and louder. He was terrified. He was afraid to breathe. Louder and louder it got. And then it seemed as though the whole temple began to shake and tremble all around him. He was too afraid to look out. Too afraid. The sound went on. And then even in the dim light where he was, everything went black suddenly. The candle in the window must have gone out. The shrieks got louder and louder and louder. And then all of a sudden, there was silence. Nothing. He stayed where he was. He was too afraid to come out. And finally, he fell asleep. In the morning, a ray of sunlight came through a crack in the door of that cabinet and woke him up. He pushed open the door. As he stepped out of the little cabinet, in front of him he saw a great pool of blood that stretched toward his feet. And when he looked across the pool of blood, on the opposite side of the temple was a rat the size of a cow. It was dead, lying in the middle of the pool of blood. But who had killed it? What had happened? Then he looked up at the wall where all the cats were painted, and he noticed that on the mouths of every single one, blood still glistened, wet and red. And then he realized what had happened. He realized who had killed the great rat. And then he realized why the old priest had said to him, avoid large places at night, stick to the small. For when he'd arrived at that temple, he had no idea it was haunted. Haunted by an enormous goblin rat. Brave samurai warriors had come and tried to kill it, but they'd never been seen again. The boy went out of the temple and found the people of the village, and when they heard that the rat, the goblin rat, was dead, they rejoiced. And they celebrated, and they praised the young boy. He stayed there at the temple. New priests came back. He did become an artist, a very famous artist, and from far and wide people came. They came to see the cats that were painted on the temple walls. And even though nowadays the temple has fallen into disrepair and ruin, they do say that if you're able to find the temple, there's still a wall standing, and if you look very, very, very closely, you can still see the faded remains of cats painted on the wall. And if you look even more closely, you might even see a little touch of red. And that's the story of the boy who loved to draw cats. Thank you very much, and I think we're back to Dale now.
I'm going to tell one story to finish off with tonight. And because we've had stories from all over, and because we just had St. Patrick's Day, I wanted to finish off with an Irish story. And Eleanor and I were on CBC Radio today, and someone phoned in with a fairy story from Port Union way, Little Catalina. And I thought, well, I'll tell an Irish story, and I'll tell a fairy story. So this is an old fairy story from Ireland. And it was collected by a man by the name of Eddie Lenihan. And it's called The Fairy Frog. And it's about how fairies can take different forms. Sometimes they don't look like us at all, and sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. And the story took place many, many years ago. And it was said to take place in the early part of the 1800s. And it's about a poor family, a poor mother and father, who had one daughter. And she was about 15 or 16 years old, and she was a very good-looking young girl. And in those days, if you had a good-looking young daughter and you were poor, you didn't always advertise the fact, because sometimes, you know, the landlords could come and they could take your daughter away, and you might never see her again, and they'd use her for a servant or something in their homes. So they would send the girl up into the high field with the cow, and it was her job to look after the cow during the day. And then she would bring the cow home at night. Now, the girl, for her part, loved this job because she thought it was the easiest, best job in the world. All she had to do was go up the high field, sit at the top of the hill, and watch after the cow all day, and then come home in the evening. And on this one particular day, she was up at the top of the hill looking out over the countryside, and what should come hop, hop, hopping out of a gap in the stone fence but this enormous frog? And the frog hopped right on over and stopped right in front of the girl and looked up at the girl with big black eyes. Well, the woman was amazed at this. This was an unusual thing to happen. She just stared down at the frog, and this frog stared back at her. And as she looked at the frog, she saw that the frog had a great, huge belly, as if it was about to give birth. "By God," said the woman, "I'd love to be there when whatever you're holding back sees the light of day." And the frog just blinked its eyes at her, and then it turned around, and it hop, hop, hopped out of the fence and disappeared. And the girl really didn't think much of it. She didn't say anything. She took the cow home that night. She didn't tell her parents, and she forgot all about the frog that she'd seen that day. And several weeks went by. And then late one night, after the girl had long been in bed, her parents were sitting up having a cup of tea, like you would, and they heard a great clattering of hooves out on the road. And it was a sound like a man riding along on a horse. "By God," said the father, "he's in some hurry, wherever he's going." And sure didn't the horse stop just outside their door, and before too long there was a knock at the door. Well, they were in no mood to answer the door to a stranger at that time of night, so they kept quiet, and they didn't say a word. But again, the knock came, and a man's voice called out, and he said, "Open up, I have business to discuss with you." And it must have been something in the way he said it, because the father went over, and he opened the door, and there, standing there, was a gentleman, a fine cut of a man in good clothes, great riding clothes with great boots and a great cloak over his shoulders. And they asked him in and asked him if he'd have a cup of tea. "No," he said, "I have business to discuss with you. Do you have a daughter?" "Yes," they said, "we have a daughter. I want her to come away with me tonight." Well, there wasn't a lot that they could do. They were only poor people. They didn't even own the land that they lived on. And when a man came and asked you for something, a gentleman, you had to do what he asked. And so they went up and they woke the girl. And they said, "There's a man here, and he says you have to go away with him." Now, the girl didn't want to go away in the middle of the night with a stranger like that, but the man was kind to her, and he said that he'd look after her and make sure that she was home the same time the next night, and he would do everything he could to ensure that no harm would come to her. And so her parents said she had to go, and the girl, with tears in her eyes, well, the man took her out and got up on his horse, picked the girl up, put the girl behind him on the horse, and away they went. And the parents waved off, and they had tears in their eyes as well, because I'm sure they thought that they would never see her again. And off he rode, and he rode like the wind. And he rode for a great, great distance. And eventually he came to a hill. And at the top of that hill there was a fort, and he rode right up to the main door of that fort, and he stopped, and he said to the girl, "We're here, follow me." And he got down off the horse, and away they went. And they went into the fort, and there was a great crowd of fine people in beautiful clothes, the most beautiful clothes this girl had ever seen in her life. "Come along with me," said the man. And they walked through the crowd, and everyone parted to let them pass, and they all bowed to the man as if he was a man of great importance, which I suppose he was. He led her through the hall. And at the end of the hall, there was a fine set of stairs, and he led her up the stairs, and at the top of the stairs, there was a door, and behind the door, there was a bedroom, and he led the girl into the bedroom. Now, the first thing she saw when she went into the bedroom was one of those great big four-poster beds, and in the bed, there was a woman who was about to give birth, and the midwife was there, and all the servants were gathered around staring at the young girl. "Go on," said the man, "they're waiting for you." Now, the girl was terrified. She didn't know what she was doing there, and everyone was just standing there watching her. And the man said, go on over to herself and hold her hand. So she went over to the bed where the woman lay about to give birth, and the woman in the bed held out her hand, and the girl took the woman's hand and held it. And the woman didn't say a word. She just stared up at the girl with big black eyes. And before too long, a baby was born to that woman, but the baby was dead. The midwife took the dead child and she passed it to the first servant. And then that servant passed it to the next servant, and so on and so forth, all the way down the line until it came to the last servant. And the servant went over and laid the body of the dead child in the fire and heaped up turf on it until there was a great roar and blaze in the fire. And they all stood there until the fire burned away the child and there was nothing but ashes left. And then the man came back and he said, come away with me just now. And as he started to lead the girl out, another servant came, and she had a baby in her arms, a living human child that very night had been stolen away from its parents. And the servant came in, and it gave the living child to the woman in the bed, and she began to nurse it. Come away, said the man, come away, there's serving dinner. And he took the girl down into the great hall, where there were tables laid all out with fine food, better than you'd ever see in any kind of hotel. And he sat down, and the girl sat beside him. And servants came around, and they offered her beautiful-looking dishes of food, but she remembered something her father had told her. And her father had told her years before that if you're ever taken away by the good people, you should never eat anything they offer you, because if you do, you'll have to stay with them till the end of time. And so she said, no, thank you. And three times the servants came and offered her food, and three times she said no, and all the while the man watched over her. And when it was done, they cleared away the food, they cleared away the tables, and there was a dance, the finest kind of music that she had ever heard, and everyone got up and started to dance, but no one asked her to dance. And so she sort of walked around. And she went back up the stairs, and she peeked into the bedroom where the woman was still lying in the bed nursing the child. And she saw that some of the servants were sweeping out the ashes where the first child had been burned. They collected up the ashes, and she watched as they took those ashes back to the front door, out down the front of the hall, where there was a font of water, like you'd see in a church. And they went over and they dumped the ashes down in the water and stirred it all up. Now, by this time, the dance was drawn to a close, and singly and in twos and in threes, people started to leave the hall. And as they went out, she watched, and everyone who left the hall, when they got to that basin of water, they would dip their fingers down into the water and rub the water onto their eyes, and then they'd leave. Now, the man came back to her when everyone had left, and he said, sit down here on this couch. He said, you must be tired. Rest yourself. And so the girl did, and she must have fallen asleep, and she must have slept for a long, long time, for when she woke, it was becoming evening again. Day had passed, and it was starting to get dark. Come on, said the man, I have to get you back to your parents, but before we go, herself wants to see you in the bedroom upstairs. And so off she went up into the bedroom, where the woman was there with the child. And the woman looked up at her with those big black eyes, and she said, I want to thank you for coming and helping. Well, said the girl, I don't know if I did much help. Oh, yes, said the woman, you were a great, great help. Thank you for coming, and I must reward you for coming. Oh, no, said the girl, I ask for no reward. There's nothing you need to give me. Still, said the woman, you must have something. And she reached underneath her pillow, and she took out a beautiful gold necklace, and she gave it to the girl. Now, the girl had never owned anything like that in her life, and she was amazed, and she put it around her neck. It was the finest thing she had ever seen in her life. And the woman said, put that underneath your clothes, and so the girl did. She tucked it down underneath her dress. And then she reached again, and she took out a purse of gold coins, and she gave it to the girl, and she said, there you go, take those home. And the girl thanked her, and she said, oh, these will be wonderful. My parents will appreciate this very, very much. And then the man came back, and he said, come away with me. We must be leaving, and we must be leaving now. And off they went. They went down the great stairs and through the hall, and she watched. And before the man went out the door, he did the same thing as everyone else. He dipped his two fingers down in the water, and he rubbed the water into his eyes. And he left. And the girl thought, well, everyone else has done it. Perhaps I should do it too. And she dipped her finger down into the water, and she rubbed some of the water onto her left eye. But as soon as she did this, the man came back, and he caught her by the elbow, and he said, we have to be leaving. We must go. We're in a bit of a hurry. And he led her out. And he put her up behind him on his horse, and away they went, and they rode like the wind. But this time, they only rode a short distance until they came to a grove of ancient trees. The man stopped his horse, and he turned back, and he looked at the girl, and he said, when you went up to see herself in the bedroom, did she give you anything? Now, at first, the girl didn't answer because she was afraid that the man would take away what the woman had given her, and she'd never owned anything so fine. But the man said, you must tell me, did herself give you anything? And the girl said, yes, and she drew the necklace out from under her dress, and she said, she gave me this beautiful gold necklace. Yes, said the man. And you're not the first one she's given a necklace like that to. And if you ever want to see your parents again, you'll do exactly as I tell you. And he took the girl down and put him down off the horse. And he said, I want you to tie that necklace around the branch of that tree. Now, the girl didn't want to do this because she'd never owned anything so fine. But the man said, if you ever want to see your parents again, you'll do it. And you'll do it now. And so, crying, she took off the necklace and she tied it around the branch of the tree. And the man, as quick as a flash, grabbed her by the hand, hauled her up, put her behind him on the horse, and away they rode, and they rode like the wind. And they were only gone a short distance when she heard a clash of thunder and a great flash of lightning, and she turned back, and she saw that that great tree was split asunder and all burnt up. "There," said the man, "aren't you glad you took my advice?" And he rode all the way and took the girl home. Now, when he got home, he took the girl down off the horse, and he said, "Now, did herself give you anything else when you went up to see her?" "Oh, yes," she said. "She gave me this bag of gold coins." He said, "Ah, yes," he says. Those are fairy coins, and you have to spend them all within 3 days. And if you don't, you'll have nothing left to show for it." And he took her into the house, and her parents were overjoyed to see her back. And they took her into their arms. And they asked the man if he would stay and have a cup of tea, and he said, "No, I have to be leaving." And he said to the girl, "But remember what I told you." And he went out and he got on his horse and off he rode and disappeared into the night. What did he tell you?" they said to her. And she told him the whole story about the frog and the woman and the baby and how the first baby had been burned and the necklace. And finally she told him about the gold coins and how they had to spend them within 3 days. "Well, that's exactly what we'll do," said the father. And the very next day they went into the market. And they bought all kinds of cattle and horses and fine clothes for themselves. And by the end of 3 days, they only had a few gold coins, sovereigns, left. And the man put them down into his pocket before he went to bed that night. And the next morning, when he got up and he put his hand down into his pocket to take out those last few gold coins, there was nothing there, only a few old dried leaves. Well, they were rich people by that point. And they moved away from that place and they bought their own place. And they raised their cattle and their horses, and they would go from fair to fair and market to market, selling their cattle and buying more cattle. And they became very wealthy people indeed, and they were known all throughout Ireland for the quality of their horses and cattle, and they would go from fair to fair. Now, years passed, and towards the end of it, the girl, now a woman, became just as good as her father in the horse trade, and everyone respected her as a great businesswoman. And one day, when her and her father were at a fair, her father was finishing up some business, and she said that she was going to go off into the town, up to the high street, and she was going to buy some nice things for her mother and maybe something for herself. And so off she went. And as she walked along, she was looking into the windows of all the shops. And as she did this, she was looking into the window, and she thought she saw the reflection of someone that had been at the dance that night all those years before. And she turned around, and sure enough, there, here and there in the crowd, were a few faces that she recognized, people who had been at the table and people who had been dancing. She even thought she saw one of the servants that had been in the woman's bedroom. And then looking down the road, who should be walking towards her but that fine cut of a man, that handsome man in his fine riding clothes and his riding boots and the great cloak over his shoulders. And she called out to him and said, "Hello." And the man came up to her, and he looked at her strangely, and he said, "Can you see me?" "Well, yes, of course, I can see you," said the woman. How could I say hello to you if I couldn't see you?" And the man came up right close and looked at her right in the face, and he said, "Can you see me with your right eye?" And the girl said, "What do you mean, can I see you with my right eye?" And he said, "Just close your left eye and tell me if you can see me." And so the girl did this. She closed her left eye, the eye that had been touched with the water. And she said, "No," she said, "I can't see you now." "No," said the man, "and you never will." And he took his finger and drove it into the woman's eye and blinded her. And she never saw with it again, not for all her money. And that was the way it always is with the good people. You might get something out of them, but you might end up wishing you never had it to begin with. And that's the story of the fairy frog. So thank you all very, very much, and happy World Storytelling Day. I want to thank Eleanor Benjamin, and I want to thank Perry Chafe for organizing things here at the Rooms, and I want to thank the Newfoundland and Labrador Arts Council for helping us fly Eleanor in from Corner Brook. And I hope you will all go out and tell those stories to all your friends. And there's lots of storytelling stuff happening over the next few months, so I hope to see you all again. Thank you all very much.